Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan, also author of Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Your Negative Emotions. Today, we're going to dive into the latest news with a guest we've had on. I had on just 7 weeks ago. How often do I do that, folks? Not real often.
I'm honored to be back.
And there she is. It's Paula Joan Kaplan. I'm going to introduce a little differently, just a slight difference than usual. I'll introduce Paula first, and then I'm going to read you some news material for all of us to discuss. Paula is a psychologist who does clinical and research work. She's an activist. She's interested in social justice, human rights. She writes nonfiction, but she's also an award-winning playwright, screenwriter, actor, and director. And she's currently an associate at the Harvard University Du Bois Institute and director of Voices of Diversity Project. And she's also been a fellow at the Women and Public Policy Program at the John F. Kennedy School of Government. You will be shocked that she has maintained, if you haven't heard it before, such a voice of clarity and honesty, speaking truth to authority, and still has all those credentials.
Thank you.
That's something we could discuss on yet another show. But let me get to the news of the day for all of us to discuss. Yesterday, good old Benedict Carey at the New York Times, who never saw a drug he didn't love, but right, also had been willing to be critical a little bit at times, reports on the fact that 2 million people in America have a diagnosis of schizophrenia, and then summarizes a study that isn't published yet. It's going to be out apparently tomorrow. And this study is what I want to talk a little bit about, and then I want to talk a little bit about some comments by one of America's famous psychiatrists that Paula Kaplan has spoken about in some depth. Well, the study has two groups of young patients who are having their first psychotic or deeply distressed experience, typically with hallucinations and delusions. It gets called schizophrenia. And this Carey starts out by admitting, well, not quite admitting, but he starts out saying these drugs work extremely well for some people, eliminating psychosis with few side effects. Actually, I've never seen such a person, but maybe there are some out there. And then he goes on, but most, he admits this, times are changing, but most who take them find that their bad effects, whether weight gain, extreme drowsiness, or emotional numbing, are hard to live with. Nearly three-quarters of people prescribed medications for the disorder stopped taking them within a year and a half, studies find. Now, this study is being praised by quite a variety of people, including, but remember, no one's read it yet in detail, Mary Olson, who is a wonderful woman at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, who's been developing Open Dialogue for the U.S. That's a Finnish program that is far, far ahead of this particular study. I don't know her very well, Mary Olson, but maybe Paula might get around comment on her. But on the other side, we have some of the great brain busters. William Carpenter, whom I once debated a long time ago and who was just pushing drugs. John M. Cain, he's a former big FDA person. He's been up against John in a tardive dyskinesia suit, where he was, of course, on the side of the state hospital, and I was on the other. We did win that suit in Alaska a number of years ago, and the woman did get compensation. Now, the study recruited, it says here, 404 people with first-episode psychosis, most diagnosed in their late teens or 20s. half got the combined approach, which is a combination of educational interventions, family interventions, therapeutic interventions, and drugs. And about half got treatment as usual, what a euphemism for were drugged heavily. And clinicians monitored both groups. They used standard checklists, by the way, which are really gruesome because they were all developed by the drug companies. And now the big deal is that in the combined group, they not only got psychotherapy and educational interventions, which are not described in any detail, they had a reduction of 20% to 50% of medication. So they got between 20% and 50% of the usual amount of medication. And as it turns out that in the long haul, over a period of a year or more, that the people did best who were in the combined group with the reduced medication. And comments here now, the comments, one of the lead investigators, he says, it's been a long haul. But it's worth noting that it usually takes about 17 years for a new discovery to make it into clinical practice. Or he says, that's at least the number people throw around. But this process only took 7 years. Actually, this process has taken hundreds of years.
Right.
We knew back in the 1700s that no drugs in a protected institution where people got love, attention, religious education, aids trained to be kind, worked marvelously well. And then, of course, there's Lauren Mosher's Soteria House, which comes out decades ago, even before I came out in 1991 with Toxic Psychiatry, where I talked about how much better family and psychotherapeutic interventions are. And, of course, Bert Caron wrote a scientific study of this decades ago. So, fellas, it ain't 5, 6, or 7 years. It's history that's finally catching up with you. But has it really caught up? That's going to be what's interesting, because they did not have a group of patients who received no drugs. That's how not up-to-date they are. Now, along comes a colleague of mine, and Paul's, and his name is, what is that fellow's name? It's Alan Francis. He was the chairman of DSM-IV Task Force. And he goes on to say, commenting mostly on the article, that this package informs the best practice in most other developed countries. Actually, the best practice in most other developed countries is to give minimum or no drugs, not 20 to 50% of what's given in the U.S.
Right.
They have much better service deliveries.
Right.
And he says, for people with severe mental illness, there has never been a better time, never been a time and a place worse than now in the United States.
Uh-huh.
Well, gee whiz, Alan, isn't that in good part your fault?
Yeah.
As the former chair of DSM-IV, with that, I hand over the phone and sit back and let Paula Kaplan, spelled with a C, C-A-P-L-A-N, PhD, talk to you. Paula, what do you
think? Thank you. Thank you, Peter. Well, let me start by responding to the last bit that you said, which is that I want people to know that Alan Francis is actually very commonly and publicly now saying that it's really a shame that people who need antipsychotic drugs are being deprived of them. And, of course, he calls them antipsychotic rather than neuroleptic, which would be the truth, which means it suppresses the whole central nervous system. But the marketing term, which he uses, is antipsychotic, like they help you get over something that you don't want to have. So I think it's, you know, he's talking out of both sides of his mouth. But let me address the most fundamental issues. Whenever somebody says that X kind of approach is better than Y kind of approach for treating people who have a particular mental illness, so in this case, even talking about schizophrenia, I think the first question we need to ask is there such a thing as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or borderline personality or whatever it is? In other words, not ask whether people suffer. Of course they do. I'm not questioning whether or not some people have hallucinations, hear voices, whether they believe things that most other people don't believe. Of course there are people like that. But that's very different from saying, and there's this entity that we're calling schizophrenia, and we know what it consists of, and we know how to do research on helping people who have this. Now, years and years ago, when I was on two DSM-4 committees, and then I resigned because I was so horrified by the way they ignored the research about, do these entities exist? Are they real? Is labeling anybody helpful to them? Does it ever hurt them? Of course it hurts them, but they weren't interested in those issues. So I resigned from the DSM-4 committees, and I was writing a book about it because I thought I never would have known how diagnostic categories are put together and how utterly unscientific they are if I hadn't been on those two committees. And one of my specialties is research methodology. So, you know, I went in there, joined those committees as an advocate of the DSM because I believed their advertising, which amounted to, this is a scientific document, so these are real entities, these diagnostic categories. And then I learned that nothing could be further from the truth. And so I was writing about this because I thought the public needed to know and deserved to know. When you walk into a therapist's office, you need to know that if they give you a label, there's no science behind it. It probably won't help you except to get insurance coverage for your therapy, and it can hurt you in an enormous number of ways. I think we talked about some of those last time. Well, so I was writing this book, which is called They Say You're Crazy, How the World's Most Powerful Psychiatrists Decide Who's Normal. That is, the people who were writing the DSM-4. And I was about to write the following thing. This was back in 1994. The book came out a year later. I was about to write, nobody's ever been able to come up with a good, solid, workable definition of mental illness generally, never mind each of the categories in the DSM. And even the authors of each edition of the DSM admit that they just had a heck of a time finding a good definition of mental illness, and they don't really come up with one. You could drive a truck through all kinds of problems in their definitions. Well, Peter, if you can't define mental illness, how do you think you're able to define each of the many hundreds of categories of mental illness in the DSM-4 and the DSM-5? You can't. So I was about to write, however, probably there are some things that we should consider mental illnesses, like schizophrenia. That's the one everybody always goes back to. You know, you can say that washing your hands many times a day is or is not a mental illness. You can say that being sad and scared and despondent if you've been raped is or is not a mental illness. But schizophrenia, that's the fallback thing. And everybody would say that's a real mental illness, right? And then an issue of one of the psychological journals arrived at my door, and I started reading it. And there was an article by one of the people who's been considered one of the top experts on schizophrenia for decades. And he said, he basically said, I hate to say this, but it's a wastebasket term. Now, I have heard of people who, I heard from a woman whose husband had a midlife crisis and had an affair and bought a red sports car, you know. And the psychiatrist said, oh, well, he's schizophrenic and you should leave him, and put him on neuroleptic medication, which made him much worse. He got himself off the medication. He got through his midlife crisis and he was fine. She was hurt, of course, but he was fine. He clearly wasn't what should have been called schizophrenic. There has been some excellent research by Will Spaulding, Mary Cunningham, and Jeffrey Poland on people who have been labeled schizophrenic, because certainly lots of people get that diagnosis. And what they found by doing a massive number of kinds of tests and investigations and interviews was that pretty much what you find when you really listen to somebody who's gotten this label is that there was some probably cognitive glitch early on that they were probably born with. And so they didn't respond to ordinary treatment or behavior from parents and others the way most people respond. And so, since they were behaving differently, the people around them then started treating them more differently, and there was a snowball effect. So these people became more and more unusual, and then they got called schizophrenic. And what they found, and they've written about this in their book, I think it's called Treating Serious Mental Illness, but anyway, what they found was that when they talked to these people about, here's what we found about how you operate cognitively different from other people, they started being able to get at, well, what's gotten in the way of these people functioning and having happy, productive lives? And they made enormous progress. So that's a really important finding. And there's another one, which is all through Robert Whittaker's brilliant book, Mad in America, because that was about how people were acting differently, and then these certain drugs came on the market, they were given the drugs, and they started acting in similar ways. Their emotions were very flat, they were emotionally suppressed, they were often jumping from one subject to another, and so on, loose associations. And then guess what? Those effects of the drugs got officially listed as the characteristics of something that somebody decided to call schizophrenia. So I think that that whole background is really important, because what that means is when you're doing a study of what helps schizophrenics, what you're really doing is a study of what is helpful to an enormous variety of people, each of whom has gotten this label, and for very different reasons. So do we find from this new study that nobody's read yet that getting off psychiatric drugs is helpful? Heavens, yes. But we've, as you say, we've known that for a long time, thanks largely to Peter Breggin and Bob Whittaker and David Cullen and some other people. So this is not news. It's great that somebody's writing about it again. But I think that we should understand that what this study probably shows is that these so-called antipsychotic drugs are harmful to people, and the less you take, the better. Occasionally, I'm told, they are helpful to somebody and not harmful, but as you and Bob Whittaker have documented over and over and over, far more often they do harm rather than good. And I think that's what we learned from this study.
Well, I think that's right. Now, they didn't take anybody off, as far as I can tell.
No, just reduced it, right? So
they just
it's
reduced
not
it.
Do you do better off them, it's do you do better with less of them. Sure.
Yeah.
Most people
will. Less and less and less and less and less until you have none would be the answer.
Yeah.
But they don't want to yet defy the pharmaceutical industry. I guess they figure the pharmaceutical industry can do with a little less profits, with a little less drugs being given, but they're not going to threaten those interests upon whom they have lived forever.
Right.
In any great way.
You know, Peter, what this reminds me of is that some years ago I read an article, I think it was in the New York Times, and it was a report of a study, and the research question had been, what helps teenagers who have depression? And, you know, the whole point of how you define depression and the millions of different things that that gets applied to, that's similar to schizophrenia. But in any case, the question was, what helps teenagers who have depression? Does psychotherapy help, or do antidepressant drugs, so another marketing term, antidepressant drugs, help, or a combination of therapy and antidepressant drugs? And I was reading through this, and it was really, something was bothering me, and I couldn't figure out what it was, and then I realized, oh, duh. What's bothering me is, how come that's all they were asking about? We know that physical exercise can alleviate sadness or lowered moods or even sometimes despair. It can help in all sorts of ways with your mood. How come that wasn't included in the study? We know, of course, there's no money to be made from that. We know that meditation can be helpful for people who are having moods that are upsetting to them. That wasn't included in the study. So can doing volunteer work. So can having a pet. So can having a friend. So can doing community action or political involvement. So can writing. So can performing in the arts. None of those things was included in that well-funded study. And so these poor teenagers who are getting diagnosed as depressed, just like the people who are getting diagnosed with schizophrenia, are not being offered, first of all, a range of options to help them feel better or function better, and they're not even being told that there are all sorts of other things that many people have found to be helpful. So this is really not allowing people even to make informed decisions, because you're not giving them even a hundredth of the information that's out there. And as a lawyer once pointed out to me, she said, now, wait a minute. She said, are you saying to me that there's no scientific basis for the diagnostic labels? I said, that's right. And she said, and then you're saying that people are saying, well, because you're depressed or because you're schizophrenic, we're going to do treatment X or approach Y. I said, that's right. And she said, then all of this treatment is experimental, and so you're subjecting patients to experimental treatment without their knowledge or consent. And I said, that's absolutely right. And why the whole world doesn't get that yet, I don't know.
Wonderful. You're expressing so clearly so many good ideas. Let me go back to one thing you said early on that concerns me, but I didn't want to disrupt your really good presentation, some really basic ideas. You said that some of the studies that you've looked at had shown that there was a cognitive glitch that people might be born with. And I want to go back to that, because I don't think you believe that there's a genetics of schizophrenia or something like that.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. Okay. No, I don't. And I wanted to mention Jeffrey Poland, who's one of the three people that did this work about the glitches. I think I probably slightly oversimplified it, but that's part of what's important about their work. And it's Will Spaulding with Spaulding, Will Spaulding, Mary Cunningham, and Jeffrey Poland. You can look up their book on Amazon. And my computer's not working right. Look it up for you and get the title right. But Jeffrey Poland, who is he's a therapist, he's a historian of psychology, he's a brilliant critical thinker. Well, he wrote a chapter that I wish everybody who's interested in what gets called schizophrenia would read, and it's in a book that I edited called Bias in Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his chapter in that book is about the research on so-called schizophrenia, and how everybody think, not everybody, you and I don't think, but many people think, yeah, but schizophrenia is real and it's genetically based. He just takes apart those arguments. He looks at what the studies really were about, what they really revealed, and anybody who reads that chapter, which is just written so beautifully and so clearly, you don't have to be a trained therapist or researcher to understand this chapter, or anything else in that book for that matter. But if you read that, you will never again think about schizophrenia as a real thing and as something that's not only real but also shown to be genetically based. And that, I'm really glad you mentioned that. No, there's a big difference between thinking, oh, you've got genes that are defective and that's what leads you to be crazy and hallucinate. Big difference between that and saying, you know, some kids are just naturally born focusing more easily on a task. Other kids are more likely to be glancing at everything that's around them and responding to everything that's around them. Well, So the world isn't set up to deal with, and different cultures and different schools and different families are not set up to deal with different kinds of kids easily. And so when somebody is responding in a way that you don't quite get, or it's not what most people do, then, and I'm not even imputing any ill will or any evil to the adults in their environment, but just when somebody acts in a certain way, you tend to respond in a certain way. When they act in a different way, you tend to respond in a different way. So, for instance, I can tell you there was once a child that I was spending a lot of time with, wasn't one of my own children, but it was somebody I cared about, and this was a child who just, when you were in her presence, just seemed to be so empty emotionally. And you would try to interact with her warmly, and she just didn't seem able to respond. She didn't seem to know what this was about or what to do with it. And I remember noticing that my response tended to be, well, I'll stop trying because she doesn't know what to do with it. And then I thought, I can't believe that that's good to treat a human being that way, you know, to just withdraw from a little child. Doesn't everybody need warmth and love? But because she wasn't responding in the way that most kids do when you're warm toward them, my inclination was to pull back and to stop being as warm or offering her connection. And I think that, you know, if I had had to live with that child, I don't know if I would have been able to overcome fully my tendency to pull back. As it was, I remember making a conscious decision, well, I'm just going to continue to treat her as I treat other kids, even though she's not responding the same way. But I think it's sort of a human thing that when somebody acts a different way, you tend to respond in a different way, and that tends to make them even more different, and then you respond even more differently. And depending on who's in their environment and what they're expected to do, that can cause real problems.
I think all this is really important. Let me fill it out with some thoughts of my own and see what you think about that. I mean, we have studies that show that the families are actually different in people who end up being diagnosed with psychosis, or people who become, I would say, extremely helpless, mm-hmm. young people who get just overwhelmed.
Yeah, that, yes, overwhelmed is a really crucial word, yes.
Yeah. I proposed in toxic psychiatry that we just look at each of the so-called mental illnesses to the extent that they have a psychological reality as different manifestations of feeling overwhelmed one
yes.
way or another and responding to that.
Yes.
And we know that that there are certain things that tend to go on in the families which make it really, really hard for the children. One
yeah,
of those things,
right.
using that word glitches again, is communication glitches, the famous double bind.
Yep.
Where
mm-hmm.
The parent says one thing to the child and says another that's contradictory
mm-hmm.
and then makes believe mm-hmm. they can't understand why the child's all confused
right.
and the child
right.
just runs into a lot of trouble. Another thing about people who end up feeling very helpless and overwhelmed is that they have a very high rate of exposure to trauma and sexual abuse and abandonment in childhood.
Right.
So
right.
we need to, I think, fill out this very complicated picture, and I'm sure I haven't even begun to fill it out, of all the ways in which people end up becoming diagnosed schizophrenic. When
mm-hmm.
I was going through my training, really, in the 60s, there were a lot of studies out that nobody mentions anymore, which is that people who are poor,
mm-hmm.
economically deprived, living in squalor, tend to have much more of all the serious psychiatric diagnoses. Big
mm-hmm.
surprise, we pay no attention to that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just a lot out there about the influence of environment, including the early so-called schizophrenia studies that NIMH fostered, which led to conclusions that it was genetic, and those conclusions were found simply by lying about what was in the studies.
Yep.
Lauren Mosier was who sponsored these studies when he was NIMH. I had lunch with him when I was writing toxic psychiatry. And I said, well, Lauren, what about all these genetic studies? I mean, your group sponsored them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your biological center for the studies of schizophrenia at NIMH. And he said, yep. And I said, you know, they're always used to claim that it's schizophrenia, so-called, is genetic. And Lauren, who had sometimes could get very impatient, especially if he didn't know you, he said something like, go read the studies. So I went and read the studies for the first time. And the conclusions were that it was genetic, but the evidence was that it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was quite clear that the evidence over and over again said it was some unknown environmental factor was the actual heavy loading and the statistically significant factor here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just very, very important, I think, to just look at the effects of the environment, especially the social environment, because I view most of these problems as breakdowns in the capacity of the individual to feel safe,
yes,
loved, secure in the world. And then if you don't, your social fabric is like torn apart. You're torn apart.
Yeah,
and
that's so beautifully said. And, you know, I think that a big reason that so many people are quick to accept claims about genetic basis or chemical imbalance in the brain is that in this world we live in, people have come to realize that we have very, very little power to change the environment, certainly on systemic levels. And so people just feel powerless, and it's easier, they're sort of happier if they can think to themselves, oh, it's a gene thing, and, you know, the Genome Project's going to come up with a cure, or the drug companies will come up with a cure, rather than, you know what, we do a whole lot to get rid of what gets called depression if we got rid of poverty, if we got rid of violence. That would go a long way. But people just feel like, well, how are you going to do that, you know? Well, there are a lot of ways to do that. But people feel so disempowered, and I think that's one of the things that's made it easy for the drug companies and NIMH to perpetuate these notions about there's something physiological, and that's what we need to go after rather than making the world a better place.
Yeah. We've known from the World Health Organization studies for decades now that people do best with less medication and more extended family support.
Yeah.
And they've been diagnosed with a severe disturbance.
The term I use when I've been working with veterans, and I hope we can talk about that for a couple of minutes because it's really perfectly relevant to this, is I say, you know, we set up, I have this project called the Welcome Johnny and Jane Home Project, where we take a veteran from any era, and they don't have to be combat veterans, just anybody who served in the military, and we pair them with a non-veteran, not a therapist, who's in their community, and the non-veteran just sits and listens totally, doesn't say a word, listens with their whole heart to whatever the veteran wants to say. Well, the veterans are finding it so helpful, and the listeners are finding it's transformative for them in the most positive ways. And, you know, we think, well, now, what is that about? People say, so this is therapy, right? And I say, no, you don't have to be a therapist. This is what we used to call friendship. It's as simple as that. That's what's missing from a lot of people's lives, friendship, love, human connection. And when you say that, people say, well, that's not a very scientific thing to say, or that's kind of fuzzy, and what about psychology? What about psychiatry? And I want to say, you know, I don't know about you, Peter, but I didn't learn anything in my training as a psychologist that ever helped me reduce anybody's suffering. You either care about it or you don't. It's pretty obvious in most cases what's going to be helpful to people, but we as a society are not set up to deliver that. So instead of saying, well, somebody thinks that there are aliens landing and they're out to get them, and so they're terrified and they're attacking people, and so let's get them locked up and on drugs, what we should say is, let's get them somewhere they feel safe. Let's let them know that people care about them. Let's find ways that they feel are helpful to them, rather than saying we're going to come in as the experts with our locking you up and ordering you into care is in quotes, and getting you on drugs. That's just a totally wrong way to approach this. And, you know, if you look at the NIMH data and the World Health Organization data, and you see that the rates of disability from so-called mental illnesses have skyrocketed once these drugs have come on the market, then why are we as a whole society not saying, so we must be doing something very wrong and we must not be doing enough of what's right? And that's where we need to go with this. And thanks to you, some people are doing that, but I just want to see it happen a lot more.
Very, very much so. I don't know if we talked about this during the last time you were on the air with me, which was September 2nd, if people want to go back and find it on PRN-FM or on Podbean. You can find the earlier shows.
And Peter, I've heard from people from Europe who've heard those shows. This is wonderful. You get such a great audience, people who really care and are interested.
Yes, it's wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful audience. I'm sure it's the best audience in the world.
I think it
is. The best group of people in the world when it comes to psychiatric mental health issues.
Yes.
To take out the time to listen to so much talk for an hour and hear ideas like this. But one of the things that I've been looking at a lot is anthropology, and which I actually studied in college. So I've been interested in a long time, but I've been looking at it a lot more now, and what's called paleoanthropology, which is looking back at a prehistory of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And the development of the human being, probably 2 to 3 million years old, in terms of maybe even more, maybe 6 or 7, when we broke off from the chimpanzee line, that ape line,
mm-hmm.
has been about people living in small groups.
Mm-hmm.
And 100,000 years ago, 200,000 years ago, but even much longer ago, but certainly then, we were living in groups that were primarily family-based. They might have anywhere from a few people in it, 30, 40, or 50. They were loosely organized around somebody who was seen as the wise one or the head and so on. But that person had no coercive powers because you couldn't coerce people who made their own weapons, made their own clothes, and got their own food on their own, basically, but who were then cooperating to live together and who were willing to support each other and support the old and support the disabled because they were family or they had joined the group.
Mm-hmm.
So from time immemorial, literally, until only the beginning of villages and cities is only 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So up to 10,000 years ago, that is 99.9% of our development, we were family-based, and we were probably nuclear family-based in a traditional sense, with men doing hunting, women doing gathering, and women doing a lot of nurturing and a lot of caring and a lot of nursing. And we had these groups of people who really supported each other and supported, as far as we can tell, their elderly, their older people, certainly their wounded people, lots of evidence for wounded people with broken mm-hmm. bones being cared for and kept alive.
Mm-hmm.
So now we expect people to live in a totally different world for which we did not evolve, which
yeah.
is no
right.
family, tiny families, take down orders coming down from above, going to schools and sitting around all day instead of running around and learning on the go in the woods and
yeah.
And in the creeks and in the lakes and so on. And we need to get back in our therapy orientation to thinking who we really are, which is an entirely socially based creature who survives when in a nurturing, caring environment in which not only are we taken care of, but we take care of other people.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, when I made a film recently called Is Anybody Listening? And it's about veterans, but it applies to anybody who needs to be listened to, which is most people I know. And one of the people I interviewed is a psychologist named David Collier. He's a Vietnam veteran and a psychologist, and he runs the Vet Center in Salem, Oregon. And when I was doing the research for the book, the book was prompted partly by the starts of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I thought, oh my God, we are a more psychiatrized country than we've ever been before in any war, and everything is interpreted as sign of a mental illness, and I was really scared because I thought, what's going to happen is people are going to come back from these wars devastated, because that's what war does, but now the whole country is going to say, oh, we know what that is. That's a mental illness. It's called PTSD. So now here's what you do. You go see your therapist, close the door behind you, because we don't want to hear about it, and take your drugs. And that's exactly what has happened. And when I was doing the research for my book about veterans, which is called When Johnny and Jane Come Marching Home, How All of Us Can Help Veterans, which is exactly what you're talking about, the community getting involved, individual people connecting with veterans and with their families. When I was doing the research, I thought, well, I don't know much about veterans, so I'm not going to start out by having interview questions. I'm going to start out by listening to whatever veterans want to tell me. And so I would just sit and listen, Peter. I would listen for 2 or 3 hours to whatever a veteran wanted to say. And what happened was I would get an email the next day, and this was like 12 years ago, and it would say things like, you know, after you just sat and listened for 3 hours yesterday, I slept for the first time since I got back from Vietnam or from Iraq. And I thought, all I did was listen. Nothing I learned in my training, nothing that you can't do at a mac and cheese supper at your church. That was all I did, was just listen. And so what you're talking about, that prehistoric living in a community, living in close connection with other people, and when you say they helped people who were wounded, yeah, and that included people coming back from war. They knew it was hell. They didn't expect them to struggle through it on their own. They said, we're here to help you. What can we do? And we will listen to what you've been through. And that's what's missing. It's certainly missing for people who have been subjected to other kinds of trauma, rape or child sexual abuse or wife battering, or the violence of poverty, racism, sexism, classism, ageism, homophobia. It's all about community. So when I was doing this research, coming back to Dr. David Collier now, I would ask every vet that I listened to, what was helpful to you? And there was only one vet out of the hundreds that I listened to who said that a therapist had ever been helpful to him, and it was this guy, David Collier. So I called Dr. Collier, and I told him why I was calling, and I said, what is it that you do that somebody who's not a veteran and not a therapist could not do? And he said, absolutely nothing. He said, you know, in our training programs, we pussyfoot around and we talk about empathy. We say it's all about empathy, but it's really about love. And here's this big Vietnam vet saying it's all about love. And that's why he's been helpful when other therapists haven't.
It is all about love. And I think it's in my Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety book, I say there's love and then there's everything else.
Oh, that's beautiful, yes.
That's true.
Right. And how come people think you have to have a PhD or you have to be a psychiatrist or you have to have all kinds of training to care and to listen supportively? It's just, how can we have lost sight of that? It's tragic. And when people will call me and say, well, I want to be a listener to a veteran or a veteran's partner, spouse, or parent or adult child, and then they'll say, you know, I don't know if it's really going to be helpful. And then I show them. We did a study. You'll love this, Peter. People would say to me, well, how can listening help? So So I wrote an essay on my Psychology Today blog called The Astonishing Power of Listening. But then I thought, okay, yes, I'm going to have to persuade people that listening with your whole heart is helpful. How sad that we have to get data for that. Everybody should know that. And there are studies out there. They're called studies of social support, you know, that sort of thing. But what we did was, I was at Harvard Kennedy School. We got a small grant, and we just had people who were not therapists just sit and listen to veterans from World War II right through to the present. Some were combat vets, some were not. And then we asked them afterward, we asked each vet, basically, what, if anything, was helpful about this and what, if anything, was negative about it. And they all said it was helpful. They said, nobody's ever just sat and listened. You know what people say to vets? If you've been deployed, they'll come up and say, hi, did you kill anybody? That's the first question. I mean, it's just horrible for the vets to be subjected to this. So to have somebody just sit and listen to whatever they want to say, and to know it's private, and to see that the person is listening with their full attention and with their whole heart, it's just so helpful. And, I mean, one vet from Vietnam told me that after this one listening session with a woman in his community, he stopped thinking about killing himself, which he had been thinking about seriously for a long time. Another woman started writing screenplays and got into a really important writer's group. And another guy started a whole art project. And so it sets people free just being listened to. When we did the study, we found, yes, absolutely. Everybody finds it helpful to be able to talk and be listened to respectfully. But then what we also found was the people who were doing the listening were saying that their lives were transformed, because when you sit with another human being and your entire job there is to listen, then you get to connect with somebody in a way that hardly ever happens. And as many of the listeners said, some of them started out saying, you know, well, I decided to do it, but I figured, oh, veterans, they're all people who signed up because they wanted to go kill people. Well, then, you know, what happens is they get in touch with the veteran's full humanity, and that brings them in closer touch with their own. So to be a listener is as magical, and often the word sacred is often used by both the speaker and the listener. So it's as important for the listener as for the speaker, and that's because it's about those connections that you point out are so frequently missing now.
I've often said therapy is a sacred trust. It's except for being a priest over the past couple of thousand years, no one has ever been in a position of being privy to the innermost thoughts of another human being, and talking with them about their lives. And it's transformed our understanding of being a human being to have this process going on. One of the things I always think about when we put all this emphasis on love and caring, which I certainly hold to. By the way, Paula, when I was a young psychiatrist and just been out a few years, I decided to interview for a separate hour, no charge, some of my patients who were doing well, and I even called a couple up who had finished to just talk to them about what they got out of therapy.
Oh, that's great. Nobody ever does that. That's wonderful. Yeah.
That was many years ago. I mean, we're talking probably early 70s.
Yeah.
And I was just surprised at what they said, because I expected them to talk about their understandings about their mothers and the trauma they'd been through, or the insights or whatever. I'm not even sure anymore what I thought. But what they said, and it was almost uniform, was I cared so much about them that they started to care about themselves.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
Now,
that's
looking
so beautiful.
At that, what's all the other stuff we're doing? I mean, I did that. I had two therapy patients today. I'm going to have another one after the show. I will be, these are people I've grown to love and to treasure, and they know that, and I'm sure that is a huge part of the experience for them. I feel that they're friends. They're people
That's lovely, and it reminds me. I'd love to tell a brief story that a man named Robert Dove told me.
I've never forgotten it.
He had been working with the American Friends Service on the GI Rights Hotline, and so people who didn't want to go to war and didn't know how to get out of it, but were in the military, when they would go AWOL, they would sometimes be hiding out. They would be afraid of being arrested and so on, and they would call the GI Rights Hotline. They'd find it on the internet in the middle of the night or something. And he said that this one young man called him and was talking about what he had been through and how terrifying it all was and how it wasn't what he had expected. And Robert was just listening. And then what happened was that this young man at some point started to cry. And Robert had just been listening, but at that point he said, "Well, I understand why you're crying, because you've been through so much that's upsetting." And this young man said, "I'm not crying because of what I've been through. I'm crying because you're listening."
Good, good.
That's that sacred trust, right?
Let me come back to something, though. We've got about eight minutes or so. And that is that, for me, even though this is the key, I think, to the most important part of healing, I still do a lot of, quote, therapy things.
Mm-hmm.
I will raise a question about whether the way they're struggling is related to something they've been through as children.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll talk about their lives as children. I'll make observations on their patterns of behavior.
You didn't think I was disagreeing with you on that, did you, Peter?
Huh?
You didn't think I was disagreeing with you
No. This isn't a question. It's not about what anything you said. It's about myself.
Uh-huh.
So, literally. So when I go through all of this and I realize, you know, I remember again and again, and I've talked again and again about relationship and love, nonetheless, the vehicle in which it's being presented to the person is this therapeutic model. And of what power do you think the therapeutic model is compared to the relationship? I don't know the answer.
Well, what do you mean when you say therapeutic model? You mean
like
making interpretations or suggesting?
Well, yeah, but we talk about patterns of failure and how they're, you know, how they're, the friendships they're making are not good for them, and where does that go back to, and, you know, why they feel so guilty doing just taking care of themselves, or even loving somebody, you can feel guilty.
Well, I think that that being cared about by another person and being listened to and being loved by another person, not only does it not get in the way of thinking more clearly about your life and how you function and whether what you're doing is working for you and what it's related to and so on, I think it makes it much easier to do that, because when you... I remember reading a long time ago about grief that somebody said very wisely, you can't grieve until you know that either you have enough people supporting you to help you get through it, or you know you have enough inner strength to do that. So I think that's what love provides, and love and respect and listening provide that that basis. And then it's easier to look at, what could I do differently, and why have I been doing it this way, and why do I believe this rather than that? So I think the two are very much intertwined, but I think with the fundamental requirement is being loved and cared about and respected, and then that helps you go on to be able to do the other things.
Well, I think so, but I still puzzle about it, because it's so clear to me how important the relationship is and the caring is, that I wonder at times whether the vehicle should be more honestly about that. And I've never thought of this before this moment, but that maybe we should call it something like how to learn how to have a loving relationship with yourself and the world, and not even call it therapy, And then the person can come in and you could establish right off that you wanted to have a loving relationship with them as a model with a great deal of protection and boundaries and to help them.
You could.
Learn.
I mean, there's some people, though, that feel that when they come to see you, they don't feel they're lovable. And so if you put it to them that way, they just won't hear that, I think. So it's, you know, it's got to be, you're the expert on this. It has to be individualized, I think. But I like your idea of just, in many cases, being much more straightforward about you are isolated, you are lonely, you're calling it depression, but what it is you're lonely, you're isolated. Let's look at that instead of saying it's this clinical thing, it's this psychiatric thing, you know, it's just, you're alone. You just moved here for graduate school. You don't know anybody. Of course you're feeling miserable, but let's not call it depression. Let's call it loneliness.
I do that. And of course, I'm very direct and honest with my clients about what I think is going on and what I think, and or patients, whichever you want to call them. I do that a great deal. We're getting near the end. We've got about a minute and a half left.
Yes.
I think it's been a really interesting conversation. I hope other people have found it interesting. Time has kind of zipped by. Yes. Some parting thoughts and maybe a reminder about how people get in touch with you.
Oh, yes. You can get in touch with me through, I have a website called psychdiagnosis.weebly.com. And I have one, I don't have anybody to keep up that website, so there's a lot of good stuff on it, though, and you can contact me through there. Or if you're interested in the veterans work, through listentoveterans.org, you can do it that way. And then my Authors Guild website is just paulajkaplan.net. And I'd love to come back and talk another time, if you want me back, about this ongoing matter of why it is that some people are doing horrible things to others in the name of therapy, and they are getting away with it, because I just find it terrifying, and I don't think it's getting any better. So I'd love to talk about that. I'm going to be writing about that soon, somewhere. I'm not sure yet where. Oh, I also blog for Psychology Today. On the Psychology Today blog, I'm not allowed to say anything that's critical of another one of their bloggers, interestingly enough. That's their policy, so I'm limited in what I can post there. But I'm looking around for another place that I can blog about whatever I want. So you can watch for that. Thank you, Peter, for all you do. You're just so terrific.
Let's maybe email about where else you might go.
Okay.
And we've been talking with Paula Kaplan. I'm excited about having her back again to talk about the really, it's a sense of talking about human cruelty, and in particular, why are therapists so cruel at times, and psychiatrists as a habit are so cruel.
Paula. Not just psychiatrists. Let's not get the psychologists and marriage and family therapists and other people who are supposedly helpers and who are doing harm.
Thank you, Paula. Thank you.